space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
Hey everybody, we're continuing, moving on through the movies. We're up to Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, which came out in 1984. It was directed by Leonard Nimoy, written by Harve Bennett, who was a producer on The Wrath of Khan. He came back and he wrote the next one. And it came out on June 1st, 1984, so we're in the mid-80s. Van Halen is at their peak, everything's going right, and Star Trek comes out with a new movie. Clay, how are you?
I'm good. I didn't realize we were so close to the anniversary on this one.
Yeah,
the 33rd anniversary.
You know what's funny about the movies is that while we were watching the show, it all happened in such a short period of time where the movies are really spaced out from each other, obviously, as movies come out, you know, 2 years maybe. Every 2 years there's a movie that comes out.
Right.
And what's funny about this one is that it takes place immediately after The Wrath of Khan, yet everything is different, you know, because yes. 2 years have passed.
I believe Uhura's hair is very different.
Yes. Kirk's is too. Shatner's obviously trying to, like, put off balding for as long as possible because
he's definitely got a new wig in this one.
Puffing up his hair and everything. But yeah, we're going to be talking about The Search for Spock. I mentioned all that at the top. The third movie. This one, the Enterprise, is commandeered, or it's decommissioned, and then Kirk has to commandeer it to go save his good buddy Spock, who landed on the Genesis planet, as we saw in The Wrath of Khan, as that movie wrapped up. So Leonard Nimoy came back. He was happy with the way The Wrath of Khan went. He came back. He said, I want to do another movie. I also want to direct it. So I'm going to play an audio clip. Me and Clay are going to come back, and we're going to break down Star Trek III, The Search for Spock.
My father says that you have been my friend. You came back for me.
You would have done the same for me.
Why would you do this?
Because the needs of the one outweighed the needs of the many.
I have been, and ever shall be, your friend.
Yes. Yes, Spock.
The ship. Out of danger.
You saved the ship. You saved us all.
Don't you remember? Jim. Your name is Jim.
Yes.
Clay, I think that this might be the first, maybe slightly, I don't know if polarizing is the right word, but I'm not sure what you think of this movie. And I know that going through the motion picture and then Wrath of Khan, both of those kind of have a sort of understanding of where they are quality wise.
Yep.
And I know that the general Star Trek rule is that the odd movies are not very good and the even movies are the better ones.
Right.
And so Search for Spock is obviously third. So it's lined up in the bad sort of pool, I guess you would say.
Mm-hmm.
I'll throw it out to you. I found this movie to be underwhelming in almost every regard. I don't know how you felt. What did you think about it? If you wanted to give like a summary,
Underwhelming is a pretty good word to use. But I think this one gets. Unjustly maligned a bit to kind of create that rule of the odd ones being bad. Cause I don't think it's bad really.
Yeah.
It's you know, coming off of Wrath of Khan, which is just such a great movie, great, you know, statement of the whole concept of the show, with lots of underlying themes that are going throughout and all these great set pieces and everything. This one is just sort of, it's like a good episode of the show.
Right.
You know, it's just like a fun adventure. It's got more charm and whimsy than the first two did, but not as much as the fourth one. It's got more money, which you can really see in the exterior space shots. Like, those models look a lot better than they did in Wrath of Khan, and the movement between them looks a lot better. But other than that, you really wouldn't know that this movie costs more to make than Wrath of Khan, because it's very small. Like, the stages are,
the sets that they use.
Yeah, the sets are very clearly limited.
I think they only shot on location for one day. The rest are on sound stages in this movie.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like they're using a lot of the same designs in some spaces, but it doesn't look as good.
Yeah.
I think because it's, you know, unfortunately, not that I would call him a bad director, but it's just not shot as well as it was in Wrath of Khan. I think Wrath of Khan gets away with hiding a lot of stuff by really creative lighting.
Yeah, yeah.
And this movie is a lot flatter lit.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that – I don't know how much Nimoy had actually directed before this. I believe
this was the first thing he ever directed.
Yeah, and it seems like that's a – I guess that's just a lot of stock in him. It's not
– The story that I heard on the DVD or the Blu-ray – is that after they hired him to do it, this is coming from Shatner, so this might be, you know, completely made up. He came to Shatner and said, I think he was doing T.J. Hooker at the time, and he said, Bill, I've never done this before. I need to basically practice before I do a, you know, big budget motion picture. Can I come direct a couple episodes of T.J. Hooker? And so he came and directed T.J. Hooker, and basically Shatner walked him through the whole thing, and
right.
then, which he found quite amusing in that very shortly after that, he was now in charge of everybody.
Yeah, I mean
– take that with a grain of salt.
I think it's a letdown after Wrath of Khan and everything, and I don't think the direction is – I think the whole movie, I kind of sum up, is it's not bad, but it's not good at the same time. It's like,
yeah,
it's kind of just there, and I think it almost works on every level of a description in that case. Like, the direction doesn't really impress me or blow me away. The the action scene, you know, the fight scene between Krug and Kirk doesn't blow me away.
Bad. Yeah, it's a bad fight scene.
And, you know, the script doesn't really do anything. The new Savick actress doesn't do anything for me.
I like that Uhura has more lines in this movie than I think she did in three seasons and two movies worth of Star Trek.
Yeah, mostly just due to that one scene, right? The transporter scene. Yeah,
but then she's not in the rest of the movie.
She comes back on Vulcan.
There's a lot of stuff that it makes it hard to believe this is a bigger budget movie, because like suspension of disbelief wise. The Enterprise is usually known for the vast number of crew that are on the ship that it takes to fly the Enterprise.
Right.
But then five people manage to steal it and fly a busted up Enterprise through however many light years they have to go or however the distance is to get to Genesis. And it feels like, oh, we could only afford five people.
Yeah, they get around it by in the script saying that Scotty has automated the entire ship, which brings up.
Oh, do they say that?
Yeah, they say that. and so that.
And even the Klingons. The Klingons, they're like, oh, how many people are on? How many? What's the crew of a Klingon bird of prey? 12.
Right. I think that I think a good way to sort of break it apart would be that the. Because you mentioned the bird of prey. This is a. I think this film's more important for the series than it is a good movie. There's a lot of firsts in this movie for Star Trek. This is like the first appearance of Klingons as we kind of would come to know them.
Yeah, the modern yeah, look. Yeah. They look like they stepped right out of TNG in this.
Right, and they kind of act like it. They have this sort of the baseline thing of honor because he kills his wife at the very start and she's down with it because she can't have the enemy getting information about what they know and stuff. And the this is the first bird of prey that we see, the Klingon ship, which is a nice design.
Which is not really as big of a deal as you'd think it would be.
You mean the fact that they introduced a new ship and they don't care about it, really?
Yeah, it's a new ship that's very powerful or like has a cloaking device, which I think is... Does the Romulans have a cloaking device, right?
Yeah, in the original series, yeah. So the Klingons... I think this is the first time we've seen the Klingons have a cloaking device. So that's a good call. I didn't even realize that.
They just kind of act as though they already know what it is.
Right, yeah. You know? Yep. The... you get your first, you know, we had the Reliant in the Wrath of Khan, which is a different ship that was originally designed to be a Constitution class. So it would look like the Enterprise in the Wrath of Khan. They realized that in the fight scenes, no one would be able to tell which ship was which ship. So they had to change it to the Reliant, became something else. But up till this movie, except for the Reliant, the only ships we've seen have been Constitution classes that look like the Enterprise. So this is the first... the movie really is like expanding the universe of showing, because you see the Excelsior class is the new ship.
Yeah, I will say, not to jump in, but the new designs I think in general are not very good. The ships, the exteriors of the ships are good, but like anything new costume wise or interiors, I think looks terrible. Like the bridge in the Excelsior is garbage.
Yes, that's
a really bad bridge.
It kind of reminded me of a. Like a JJ bridge a little bit. It's like more, everything's brighter. And
it's a lot sparser.
Yeah, it's very, very sparse. Apparently that set was only the one wall. So they just shot everything from that angle.
That makes sense.
But I like the sort of branching out of all the new ships. You get the medical ship, the Grissom is a medical ship, which would go on to like become kind of a standard design for those things. So I think that it's the first time we hear them say Kapla, the Klingons say Kapla. A couple times in this movie, so that's something that would go on.
That's the game with the balls, and it's like you have a bunch of sticks, and you pull out one stick, and then if the ball falls through, then you've lost Kapla.
Kerplunk.
Right.
So this movie feels to me like the first attempt at the universe to really spread its wings a little bit. And it's funny to me that while they did that, this movie to me also feels like the most, maybe it's just because of the product of its time. It feels to me like it's Labyrinth mixed with Star Wars a little bit.
Okay.
It feels way more fantasy than any of the previous movies have felt or the series.
I could see that.
Down to the planet falling apart at the end where it's like Hellfire is coming up and stuff like that. And he kicks the guy into the lava pit. And... It has a weird kind of tone to it that doesn't really feel super Star Trek-y to me at the same time that it's actually expanding a lot of what the universe would go on to be.
Right.
And I think that it's like, did you get any like sort of sense of the tone as compared to especially Khan before this? Because I feel like the motion picture kind of stands on its own as its own thing.
Yeah. I mean, they've made it clear that the motion picture is basically a false start,
right,
as far as the movie universe goes. The tone, it feels lighter for the most part than Wrath of Khan was, except for the towards the end there. They're kind of going on the same, not as much as they will in later movies. Once they realize that Wrath of Khan was the best one, so they just keep ripping it off. But even in this one, there is a little bit of that where Christopher Lloyd's character has the same kind of feel as Khan, as far as the enemy on the opposing bridge kind of thing.
Yeah, they're both kind of theatrical in a way.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing that I noticed in this movie is just generally there's no. Like themes.
No, there's no themes. No.
You know, coming off of Khan, which is just very, very dense with subtext, this one is just sort of like a story for the sake of telling a story, which is fine. I mean, like, I don't dislike this movie. If you're a fan of the characters, they don't do anything egregious to make you really not enjoy what's happening. Like the stuff with McCoy doing the Spock stuff is fun. That weird like Miami futuristic Miami Vice club scene where he talks to like the proto Ferengi is kind of fun.
I got a very that's a very much a Mos Eisley cantina. Yes.
Yeah, he looks just like a guy from the cantina. I can't remember which one, but when I saw him, I thought for a second they just lifted him right out of Star Wars. It's got like all the pieces, like all the bits of stuff that makes a recognizable, enjoyable Star Trek movie. It doesn't have a lot of layers to it.
Yeah, I totally agree that there's nothing really like thematic or cinematic about a lot of it. It feels more like an extended sort of TV episode that is attached to The Wrath of Khan, which I really still think is kind of interesting that they just continued the movie outright, like right after that. But I think that the thing about this one to me is that I guess Ebert called it a compromise between the tone of the first and the second Star Trek films. And I kind of understand what he's talking about because to me, it's a kind of a crippling issue that they don't have Spock for this entire movie. Right. Right. And McCoy doesn't really do a lot during it. So you're kind of left with Kirk by himself. Mm-hmm. And so I think because of that, like this is the movie clearly with the most of the supporting cast having anything to do in it, right. Like Sulu and Scotty and all of them and stuff. And I don't know, it doesn't feel complete in a lot of ways. And the fact that there's no Spock and that we're just trying to work that through, I'm really surprised that the McCoy storyline isn't more prominent here and like what it means to have Spock inside McCoy, basically.
Right, right.
They play a little bit of comedy with it at the start. If not comedy, it's just kind of like lighthearted, like Kirk's like, who's talking to me? Is that Spock? And oh no, it's McCoy sitting in the shadows talking in his voice for some reason. So I felt like that was kind of a missed opportunity to have, you know, McCoy and Spock clearly, at least through the series, have this like antagonistic relationship with each other, and they don't really explore it. They have the scene at the end where McCoy's looking at the corpse of Spock before he gives him back his mind. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like the characters really sort of lived up to or like existed in like the proper space where they should have in this one? I feel like they all came off a little bit flat.
I would agree. I think this is a weird movie where I don't think this movie would really appeal to a fair weather Star Trek fan.
No, it wouldn't.
The characters are not really there in a familiar way, but they're there a little bit in a kind of shake it up a little bit sort of way. At least McCoy is anyway. Yeah, I guess he's the only one really, now that I'm thinking about it. But the rest of them are just, you know, kind of doing their thing.
It kind of copies the motion pictures. Like the somberness of the opening is very reminiscent of the motion picture in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know? Which I mean, it's understandable because I mean,
Spock's dead.
They just killed Spock. Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to have them, you know, pull into space dock with sunglasses and guitar solos after they just shot Spock out of a tube.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's surprisingly. I mean, I was actually thinking as I was watching it, it felt kind of like they figured out the right mix of the first two. I was thinking more visually, I think, than tonally, because it has a lot. There's a lot of docking in this movie. Much like that seems to be the running theme through the first three is if they have to dock a ship, you're going to see the whole thing.
They reused that space station quite a bit. That's in TNG a few times. Yeah.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
But yeah, it feels like they figured out the right mix of quote unquote realistic space stuff and Star Trek stuff.
Yes.
But at least visually, but you know, subtextually, yeah, like there's the characters are everybody kind of gets a scene a little bit.
Yeah, they do.
But aside from that, they're just sort of there. I think one of the problems is there's no point of view character in this movie. Whereas Wrath of Khan is very much everything that happens thematically and is run through the filter of Kirk's point of view and Kirk's story.
Yeah.
And this doesn't really have that.
Right, because it's ostensibly a Spock story, but he's dead. So you can't
include
him.
If they had expanded on the McCoy thing to have McCoy as kind of be like a stand-in for Spock, where he would kind of be the entryway into seeing aspects of Spock's life and, you know, quote unquote journey that we've never seen before, that could have been really cool.
Right. Yeah.
Because as we're learning about Spock, we're actively going to find the physical form of him to reunite him as one being, and he comes out. You know, I think a lot of places have said that when Spock returns, he's a different character.
Yeah.
Like he's gone through a big character arc from the first to third movie. And I mean, it's true, but they also kind of, you know, cheat a little bit, because the first movie, he doesn't really, his arc is written down on the note card, but they don't really earn it.
Right.
And the second one, I would say, I don't know if he goes through an arc, but he's just consistent. Like,
yes, yeah.
He is who he claims to be and lives up to all of the principles that he stands for, et cetera, et cetera. And then in the third one, I guess you can look at it as being this sort of like you know, when you come back from the dead, what is it called?
Like a resurrection.
Resurrection. There we go. That's sort of like resurrection and being born anew kind of thing. But even there, they don't really go for it. It just sort of happens in the last few minutes, and there's nothing to imply that he really goes through this big change, you know?
Yeah, I was looking at the sort of theme stuff for it, and a lot of people were, you know, people have written sort of like, I don't know, dissertations or something on it being sort of the idea of Jesus Christ, like, or like any sort of religious figure that's,
yeah, sure,
you know, dead and resurrected. But I mean, if that's the case, it does a very TOS-y thing of not really examining what that means for anything.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, it's just kind of like, yeah, well, he is, I guess he is Jesus Christ, because he died and he sacrificed himself for the, you know, the many, and then he came back, and now he's back and he's with us again for another couple adventures. But
especially given the fact that Nimoy is directing it, you would think that it would be his opportunity, his chance to really make a statement on the character of Spock.
Right, yeah.
Even if, I mean, and you can still do that even if Spock's not in the movie, but they just don't. It's just sort of like a point A to point B kind of thing.
Well, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, it feels more to me like, the movie feels to me like, if it is Nimoy's directorial debut, that he was more interested in like the nuts and bolts about it, and mm-hmm. was like very concerned about getting it to, you know, doing the job of getting it to look right and having all the shots. And like, I was looking at the reviews and stuff, like he was very involved in the design process of like the ships and working with the special effects and everything.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't seem as interested in the story, and you'd think that since he plays Spock, he would be very interested in what the script is about.
Right, right.
And it doesn't really come across that way. It seems
he's just interested in that hot, hot Ponfar action.
Which, they had sex, right? That's the implication here.
I think that's pretty heavily implied, yeah.
Okay, it's not just...
or whatever pawning one's far actually means.
It's not just touching fingers and stuff. Yeah, that's... I mean, to me, the whole... Like, I, you know, as I sit here with these podcasts, I try to come up with, like, lines to, like, open them up and stuff, and 90% of the time I do a poor job. And my thing was just like, for a movie that's about bringing someone back to life, it's a kind of a lifeless movie to me.
Mm, and you should write for the New York Post.
I know. That's too many characters. I'd have to work on the Twitter or something. But I think that like, I think a perfect example is kind of like the flatness of it is that I feel nothing when David is killed in this movie.
Yeah, it's very...
It feels more like it's like, well, we had to get rid of him because we introduced him in The Wrath of Khan. And it kind of ties back to me for, remember in our Wrath of Khan discussion, I was kind of like, do you feel like the Genesis thing is almost too big of a tack on to that story? And it feels like they, because it almost feels like they were setting it up for the trilogy at that point. I don't know if they were, because mm-hmm. it seems like the movie, they were still needed that movie to be a success to continue forward. But now they've introduced this character of David and the Genesis thing. The Genesis planet at least makes sense in context of this movie, where it didn't make a lot of sense to me in Khan how much of an important thing it was.
Yeah.
Here it works out that way, so you know it's good for them that they made it a trilogy. But the character of David feels completely useless by this point to me, because he had a point in Khan. He doesn't have a point here.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of fun stuff that they do with him, where it turns out that the Genesis planet is unstable due to his own
trying to cheat the science, basically.
Yeah, yeah. His own. Pride is not the word I'm looking for, but you know what I mean.
Well, he wanted it to succeed so much that he was willing to compromise it.
He pushed the boundaries and, you know, and got a little cocky with it, and it ended up not working. And that's kind of fun if you're thinking about it as a analog to Kirk, but they don't really do anything with that. And you know, I think I said in the Khan coverage that the Genesis itself is. It works because it's not the focus. The store is much smaller, and Genesis is just sort of like the framing device.
Yeah, it's kind of the MacGuffin, but it's not really, but it is kind
of. It's a more pure MacGuffin than they tend to use them now, because it's there, and it's technically important, but it's really not that important.
Right.
Whereas usually now when they do that stuff, it's the focus of the movie, and that never really feels honest. David's weird, because I really like the way Shatner plays it when they kill him, like when he does that kind of stumble back and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, misses the chair.
Yeah. And as far as if you're going to kill a character in the movie, he makes the most sense. Not because he's useless, but like thematically and motivation-wise, he makes the most sense. Because, I mean, if you kill anybody else in the movie, it's like it feels cheap.
Right.
Not that this doesn't feel cheap, but it feels right for the story that he's the one that gets killed.
Yeah.
Because if you kill Savick, who gives a shit?
Right, and you can't kill Spock.
Yeah, you can't kill Spock. And, I mean, if it was like Chekhov or somebody down in there, if you killed them, it feels cheap. So he's the – you know, I have the same – I know a lot of people – got pissed off when they killed off Han Solo, spoilers. But if you really look at the movie, he's the only one that makes the biggest narrative impact to kill.
Right, yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing. Obviously, David is not as big of a character as Han Solo was. But, he's just – he doesn't – I think he could have done a lot more, but I don't – It's at the same time, it's tough because, I mean, he's just down on the planet the whole time.
Right.
Like, he feels like he should have a bigger role in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, his actual role is basically he knows everything about the Genesis planet, so he can go down and tell everybody and tell the audience what's going on with it. I mean, I think...
I kind of feel like he should be with Kirk for most of the movie. Like, if you're going to...
You think so.
If you're going to... Because I said in the last one that David feels kind of peripheral in Khan... And there's no real father-son stuff, but that's because it's not a father-son movie. That's not the point of the story.
Right.
I feel like they could have leaned into that in this one and, you know, had David on the Enterprise with Kirk leading
bonding
them back
over,
to
Genesis.
Yeah, bonding and under the umbrella of leading them back to Genesis for whatever reason. Like, you know, he's the only person that knows what's going wrong with the planet or some shit like that. In which case, you have this time that they spend together. Then when he goes down, you know, he could go down to the planet under some sort of like, you know, bullheaded sort of thing that Kirk would probably do. You know, like where he wants – they shouldn't go down to the planet, but he's the one that goes down, that kind of thing.
Oh, sure.
Kirk doesn't want him to go, but he's like, no, I got to go down to that kind of thing. And then he gets killed. So you have a little bit more his death has a little bit more weight.
Yeah,
to live up to the way that Shatner plays it.
Well, you could kind of. I mean, if he did do that, it's a nice analog of, you know, Kirk does the crazy thing of stealing the Enterprise in this movie, right? But David does this other crazy thing, and it actually ends up getting killed.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Kirk gets the chance to reflect on what all that means and everything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. As it stands, he's just kind of on the planet with them. And I like Shatner's performance. It's just from what we've seen of their interactions, it doesn't make any sense to me because
Yeah, I mean, we don't know if they've seen each other since the last movie.
Right, yeah. I get the impression that they... Because I don't think they share any kind of scene in this movie with each other.
No, they don't.
Yeah, so it's just... It feels a little bit just cheap to me. And I know that he's kind of the character that has to go. Even the way he goes out is not particularly great. It's like it's another... I guess Nimoy just can't really do these action scenes all that well.
You know, I actually don't mind that. I think that scene works... Okay. Like, I think I know what he was going for, and I think it works a little bit, because it does feel very sort of brutal, the way that he gets killed. It's not very dramatic. It's not like they stab him in the back and he fights him off
with a knife in his back.
Yeah, and he stumbles away, and you know, it's fairly realistic where he tries to make the move to get the guy's knife, and they just roll around and he just gets it in the chest and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the scene's a little bit clunky to me just because I think he's trying to stab Savick, right? And David intervenes. Is that...
Yes.
Yeah, that's your reading of it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how it goes. So, I mean, that's a nice little Kirk allegory, just sort of throwing himself into a problem that might not be his own thing. But I guess that would be a good point to break off with Savick. What'd you think of the new Savick character, who is the Kirstie Alley character, except not played by Kirstie Alley in this movie?
She really gets downgraded from a trainee with a lot of potential to I'm just here to sleep with Spock.
Right.
I mean, that's basically only... she's basically only there to help Spock through puberty, and that's... But you know,
yep.
I don't know. It's It, not that Savick made a huge mark in Wrath of Khan, but I mean, you could have called that character anybody.
I think it was the performance. I think this actress's performance in this is not good. She, you know, the Vulcans...
To be fair, she doesn't really have a lot to do.
I mean, the Vulcans are supposed to be emotionless, right? But she just plays it flat, and I think that's mm-hmm. a common problem with people who play the Vulcans. And we have a lot of Vulcans in this one, and I think we have the two best people who have ever played Vulcans, which would be Nimoy and Mark Leonard, who plays Sarek yep. in this movie. Mm-hmm. They both play them... they aren't flat, right? They have like character to them. They just aren't... they aren't just like reading lines with no feeling is the way to best describe how a good performance, a Vulcan performance, should come across. Mm-hmm. And she just comes across really, really just kind of dull with it. Like there's nothing to her. She doesn't kick up any of the Vulcan stuff. Like she doesn't have any of their catchphrases or anything like that. I don't know why they made her
a Vulcan.
She doesn't
do like, she'll say, that's illogical, and right. then like turn to the camera and do the eyebrow thing.
Wah, wah. I mean, she knows what Ponfar is in this, and she knows that she has to handle that. And that ties into, while we're talking about her, this is your first experience, because you didn't do a mock time, with Vulcan, like the planet Vulcan culture, mm-hmm. which is the End, which where they resurrect Spock and they do it through their sort of religious stuff. And Amok Time, this was a big criticism of mine of how they handled the Vulcans. What did you think? What do you think of the Vulcans in this movie?
It reminded me a lot of the Masters of the Universe movie.
Yes.
Where everything is like half matte painting, but everything's colored like green or like lava red. Right. And they've got lots of big headdresses and really big slabs
yeah.
for tables and stuff.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like the only other Vulcan stuff I got was in the first movie when he's trying to win that red glass Kulinar. Necklace.
Yeah, that's right.
That also takes place in like the middle of a volcano or something.
What do you?
They seem kind of... I don't know. They seem like they're making it up as they go.
Yeah, I think that's my problem. Like, I don't understand, for a race that embraces basically rationality, right? Why are they so religiously themed about everything?
Right. Yeah. And primitive too. Like they seem like they should be more, I guess that's not, it's not an absolute, but it seems like they should be a little bit more sparse and clinical.
Yeah. I picture them more like monks than
yes.
these kind yeah. of religious sort of things. So they're like, every time we see Spock,
a monk is inherently religious, right, well, I guess you could say. But I know what you mean.
More of a The monks are more of a sort of like groundedness than sort of caught up in the tradition of everything.
Right, right, right.
And the Vulcans that we've seen on the show are very caught up in like tradition and ceremony and stuff like that. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, especially when you have Spock on every episode of the show and Sarek appears on the show and they seem like exactly the way that they are. How they come from this culture doesn't make a lot of sense to me because Spock is not interested in any of this stuff. So it's weird to me that he embraces his Vulcanness to the extent that he does, if what he embraces is not at all what they are actually like on their own planet. Mm-hmm. I just think it's weird. It feels to me, like you said, like they just kind of make it up as they go, and they wanted some sort of like mystical thing because you need a little bit of mysticism to get him, his spirit back in his body.
Yeah. Once you start getting into that stuff, it's,
it's a long,
although I
long
mean,
night.
even, you don't necessarily have to, cause the whole concept of what they end up doing is basically Spock has downloaded his consciousness into McCoy's brain.
Yes. Yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily have to be a mystical thing.
No.
I guess, well, I don't know. I guess it kind of does. But.
Well, I mean, they could. There's a way to write around that and not make the high priestess of Vulcan touch the foreheads of both of them. And that's how they move back into each other.
You could do like the Young Frankenstein thing where you got them each on a table and they have like a thing connect, like in The Prisoner, where they each have a thing connected to their head.
Right.
And then they do like that weird crossfade thing, and that's the signal that they've switched bodies.
Yeah, I like the I like the design of Vulcan and everything like that. I really like the final shots of the Klingon ship landing on the planet and stuff.
That's a nice shot.
Not something you see a lot. It reminds me very much of Star Wars, but it looks nice and everything looks cool. And I like the way that it's a desert planet on Vulcan, which I always appreciate.
Feels like the first time that they've ever really landed a big ship.
I think it is. I think it might be. Yeah. And although it's a continuing funny thing about the sense of scale. The ship seems much smaller when it lands than it does when it's in space. Against the Enterprise. It feels very small and like X-wingy Star Wars when it lands
on
the planet.
Although, is it supposed to be a smaller ship?
Because
the way that they talk about it, the way that the Klingons talk about it compared to the Enterprise is they seem to be under the impression that the Enterprise could wipe the floor with them, no problem.
Yeah, they're supposed to be very small compared to the Enterprise. And like,
I guess that
the crew of 12 makes sense.
Yeah, that makes more sense why there would be 12 people on it. See, that's that's another problem you get into when you've got ships on screen together that are kind of the same size, and that's, you know, that stuff never really translates.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. They do a better, though. Their size is more apparent in something like Yesterday's Enterprise, which they do look smaller than the Enterprise in that one. But yeah, I think that it's not a movie that really holds my attention for a lot of the way. Like it kind of feels like it's just the middle step that needs to happen to get to Voyage Home. In a lot of ways, like you just kind of have to, you know, I didn't think I talked to you about this, but in Wrath of Khan, the original script, right, that they gave out to sort of see, put feelers out there to the public to see what they thought. Mm-hmm. Spock in that one pulls a psycho and died in the first act of that movie originally.
Really?
Yeah. So they changed that because the public got upset by it. So they pushed it to the very end of the movie, almost to the end of the movie, where it's actually after the crisis is averted because they escape from Khan, right? And then Spock dies.
He just dies peacefully in his sleep.
Right. So this one, like, are you happy with the amount of Spock that we get in this movie? Was it a good decision to just have him come back for the last 5 minutes of the movie? And if you notice, they don't have Nimoy credited in the opening credits.
Right. I think it could have been a good decision if they had done more to really kind of, like I was saying before, like look at his absence and what that might mean.
Right.
Or, you know, use it as an opportunity to explore the character to explore a character who famously is cold and not emotionless, but aloof.
Right.
And using the other characters in there, dealing with his absence to explore the character. That would have been really fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess. I don't know. What would you do with him if you brought him back earlier? I don't, have him come out and say, oh, wait, no, this is the code you need to beat the guy. You know, he's got no the point of the movie is just to get him back to the way that he was. And I don't know what you do within the movie once that happens.
Yeah, I think it's just it's funny to me how much of a, you know, we're engulfed in like trilogy movies at this point in our lives. So like Hollywood's gotten better at making the trilogy movie.
Kind of. I don't know.
This one feels to me like this movie has a really hard time standing on its own in a way that modern trilogies, I feel like the middle movie stands on its own a little bit. Like, and it ties back into the plot of like, there's not a lot of conflict here. They stick the Klingon stuff in there to give us something to do. But other than that, it's really just, you know, it's not like Spock is missing. They know exactly where Spock is from the get-go. They have to go get him. They take the ship. There's no problem getting away from the Excelsior at the very start.
Yeah.
You know,
that's one thing that really could have added a bit more to it. If they had done it more like Pirates of the Caribbean, where you've got the pirates ostensibly on the Enterprise, and then you've got the Klingons involved, but you also have the Starfleet, like the Excelsior should show up, is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
That would have been an interesting way to play it. I think could have been really fun, because then, you know, you've got two different groups looking for the Enterprise, or, you know, whatever.
Right, and there's the plot confusion about when they, you know, when the Klingons and the Excelsior actually interact with each other.
Yeah, and but I mean, you know, you can't. I guess you can't really do that because the destination is a known point from the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's not really a lot of chasing to be done because you know where you're going.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's called a heist movie, but it's not really a heist in any sense.
It's a heist movie for like 15 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
When they steal the ship,
and then there's no payoff to it in that sense. In that sense, it's kind of a motion picture kind of analog. But I think my original point is just that it feels like the middle act of a movie, of a longer movie, but there's not enough conflict in that middle act. It's like when everything just sort of fixes itself. You know, it's the act of the movie where everything sort of flips back to where it needs to be at the very start, and they have this minor conflict with Krug and the Klingons and everything like that. It doesn't hold my attention, really, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, they really don't. The crew of the Enterprise really doesn't have much conflict at all. Because they basically spend the first two-thirds of the movie just kind of sitting around.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they steal the ship, and they get out of it. They steal the ship pretty easily. And they get to Genesis, you know, pretty quickly. And then they shoot the, you know, they get their engine blown out. But, you know, there's only five people on the ship, and all of their names are in the opening credits, so no one's going to get blown up.
Right, yep.
Well,
that's a good point. Oh, sorry, go ahead, yeah.
And just, you know, the stakes are, I don't know, kind of low, there. Really.
Yeah. I mean, well,
you know, I was thinking as I was watching it, at a certain point, like half of the time that Kirk ends up with the upper hand, he doesn't really have the upper hand. It's just that Christopher Lloyd's character is dumb.
Yes.
Because there's a few points where he could have very easily just cut his losses and been like, you know what? Fuck you guys. I'm just going to kill everybody and get out of here. Because the only people who know that we're here are on this planet. If I kill everybody, this planet's going to blow up anyway. The Enterprise is going to blow up when the planet blows up. If I just get out of here, no one will ever know I was here.
Yeah, yeah.
So he, you know, there's no real. I know they killed David as like a show of this guy means business, but there's really no, not as much bite to him as I think they want to imply. They do it early on, but not when it counts, I guess, is the point.
You know, I mean, well, he does have a ferocious looking dog, Klingon dog, but
Caitlin was very sad when the dog
died. The dog didn't, and that's what triggers him to go down and hand to hand Kirk, actually. But I think that's
just like, this is actually just John Wick in space.
The you know, it ties into the low stakes thing. The Genesis weapon that Krug is after doesn't even work.
It doesn't exist.
Right. So it's like,
what is he going to get?
Well, I guess he wants the ability to, because he's operating on faulty information anyway, right? But then it's like, David reveals it's like, I guess the Genesis isn't actually even working because this planet is falling apart. So,
But like, what's the actual thing that he's hoping to get?
I think
he blows up the ship by accident when he gets there.
The Grissom you're talking about.
Yeah. And then David gets killed. But even before David gets killed, what's he going to do? Bring David back up under the ship and be like, so could you, like, tell me how to build one of those?
Right, yeah.
What is the actual – I mean, he's got that little tape that he gets at the beginning, but clearly whatever's on that tape is just the telling him what the thing is, not how it works or how to build it.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So I don't – now that I'm thinking about it, I don't actually know what the hell he's there for or looking for.
Right. Yeah, it's a good point. I don't think his sort of motivations are strong enough. He's really just thrown in there to sort of be a thorn in the side of everyone else that's going on.
Genesis is a much poorer MacGuffin in this movie than it was in Khan.
Yes,
because in this one it becomes the goal for the villain is to get Genesis, but there is. Like I just said, I don't know what that even means in
right.
this movie.
And it doesn't have the thematic tie-in that Khan had where
right.
Genesis is about, the birth and death cycle.
Now, if it had been to get that butt, then, there's a thematic tie-in because, he's going through Ponfar, his puberty and stuff. So,
this is the destruction of the Enterprise in this movie. What do you think of that? I put a lot of importance on scenes like this, and I'll have a lot to say when we get to Generations about how they did it there. What are your thoughts on how the original Enterprise goes out in this movie?
I like it. It becomes like a lot of other things. I think we've mentioned a few of them across these two movies. A lot of things that they do end up becoming fairly standard tropes for movies like this. Like, blowing up the ship ends up becoming the thing that happens in, like, every other movie. And at a certain point, it kind of loses its importance. But this being the first time that they did it, I think it's great. I mean, it makes sense. It's shot to shit anyway. And it's something that the fans probably wouldn't see coming.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they would, but...
No, it was actually done to be sort of a big surprise type thing. Like, that was the motivation of doing it, was to leave. Because as we're talking about, like, the plot is obvious. They know Spock is going to be resurrected at the end, so they had to add something to change things up.
I'm actually kind of surprised they didn't do it in Wrath of Khan, to be honest with you. It seems thematically almost to make more sense in Wrath of Khan because it's a letting go of the past kind of thing, and that's basically the entire theme of that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least coming to terms with your past and moving on and looking forward to your future. So I'm surprised they didn't do it there.
It does tie in,
but I don't think it ties in completely because for it to tie in completely, the movie would have to end with them getting a new one.
Right.
And they don't and I guess technically they do eventually, so whatever. I guess it does. I guess it still ties in.
I was thinking it ties in as it's Kirk's other child who's killed.
Yeah, he has a bad day.
Yeah, he has a bad day. He appropriately reacts to the destruction of the Enterprise in this one and appropriately to David's, I guess. But this destruction of this Enterprise in this movie is that I know I'm not as big of a fan of TOS as I am of TNG, but I think that the destruction of the ship is done better in this movie than it is in Generations. My problem with it is that it goes back to the thing that I think for the movie they changed the interior too much, and they get away with it by saying that the Enterprise has been like refit and everything, like it's basically a new ship. But I don't. The only thing about that's effective about Generations is that I'm on the bridge that I've been for 7 years, going to hell. Here, it feels like it's just some other ship, and it doesn't feel like the ship from the series. So I kind of feel
that's
like it loses a little bit of something for me there, although I do like the way – I like the sequence of it blowing up and everything. It's pretty awesome. And them watching it crash to the planet from the planet is a great shot.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great shot. My favorite Enterprise movie Enterprise has always been the first version of the basically this one, the Wrath of Khan Enterprise. I think it's the motion picture through Wrath of Khan Enterprise, because it's the same basic design. They just, you know, they dialed it up a little bit and made it a little bit sleeker and a little bit cooler. And, you know, as I've said before, the TOS movies were my real entrance to Star Trek.
Yep.
So I've always had an affinity for that Enterprise. And when they get the new one, which I think they get either at the end of 4 or in 5, it's an Excelsior, but it's refitted, it looks like shit.
Yeah, it is the Excelsior.
For whatever reason, I don't know why, but every time they change the Enterprise, after they blow it up, the next one they get has a much shorter neck, and it never looks good.
Yeah, it's always a little bit more streamlined. So you don't like the Excelsior design?
Not really. Not compared to, I like the classic a little bit better.
Yeah. It looks a little fat, is my problem with the Excelsior.
Yeah, the neck piece is really thick.
Yeah.
And it looks like a bendy straw.
Yes, like a bendy straw. That's better than mine. It looks kind of like fat rolls, kind of like it.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I know that, you know, the Enterprise is technically, once you get to TNG, it's a galaxy class starship, so there are other starships that look just like the Enterprise that are also galaxy.
Yep.
But in my mind, it's like the Enterprise is the Enterprise.
Right.
I don't want no Enterprise that's just the Excelsior with a new name on the side of it.
Right, yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm happy with the destruction of the ship in this one. I like the trick that they do. Like, it has a purpose.
Yes,
in this movie, like they lure all the Klingons over, and then they have the nice sequence of it blows up.
I like that Klingons don't apparently understand numbers.
Yes, yeah, they don't. The universal translator, I guess, doesn't change the numbers for them. Although they should have. I was watching one of the commentaries, and I think it was funny. It was just like when they go over, you know, the self destruct thing is on, so everything's like blinking red, mm-hmm. and the Klingons are just like, "Hey, these guys like red. We like red."
Everything. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. you do get a really great Christopher Lloyd scream. One of those, get out of there. That's a great Christopher, peak Christopher Lloyd yell.
Yeah. That's, let's just talk about the action scene, because I guess it was controversial, when it came out.
The fight scene?
Yeah. The fight scene, because Kirk, this is the first time that Kirk is actively, sort of cruelly killed someone. I think that's the best way to describe it.
That's debatable, I think.
I would say it's debatable about cruelly because of how cheesy his final line is to him. Mm-hmm. What the hell does he say? He's like, I've had
enough of you, but he says it in a very Shatnery way. It did remind me of this once. So when I was in college, my dorm room was on the – I had a single, and I was on the 16th floor, and I had a balcony all to myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our building, you know, in New York, not entirely immune to the occasional cockroach.
Sure.
And one day I saw one, you know, traipsing through my room. So I stepped on it. It was still kind of alive. But I scooped it up on a piece of paper and I brought it out to the balcony. And right before I tipped it off and dropped it 16 floors to its, I assume, demise, the best thing I could think to say in the one moment where I had like a, you know, die hard, just about to drop the villain off of a roof moment,
mm-hmm.
was, have a nice trip, see you next fall. And as soon as I did it, I was like, I'm really glad no one was here to hear me say that, because I really blew it on that one.
Well, I mean, you should have just said, I've had enough of you, and just kicked him in the face.
Basically, my point is, it's... In a high stress situation like he's in, I can understand why maybe his one liner game was not he didn't bring the A game that day.
Yeah, yeah.
And his son just died. Give him a break. His son was killed.
So you'd agree that fight scene is not all that great. I think it's fitting to the character of Kirk, however you pronounce his name, that he's put out that way. But it's just a very. It's the first time we've seen Shatner in a fist fight, which is kind of shocking in the movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, they play him as being, you know, beyond that in
right.
the movies.
Yeah.
You know?
And do you think it's a mistake to have him fight in this one, or do you just think it's a bad scene?
I don't know. I guess it depends on how you want to look at it. Because like I was saying before about how if you're a Star Trek fan, you're a fan of the original series, this kind of hits the beats that you'll be familiar with. You know, your favorite character has a line and, you know, he gets to you know, be chuckle house into the camera for a little bit. And you get your Klingons and you get your warp speed and you get your Kirk on a planet in a fist fight, which is a hallmark of the original series.
Yep.
Whether or not thematically it makes sense is debatable.
Right.
But just, I mean, the fight itself is just not very, it's just not very interesting. And there's nothing to it. Like, there's no, if this fight happened in Wrath of Khan, Kirk would lose the fight or be losing the fight because he's fucking old.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they don't follow through with any of that stuff in this one.
He doesn't even really have the anger for David's, like, he's not rageful or anything
right.
like that. Like,
honestly, David's death, the best thing they do with it is bring it back in Star Trek VI.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it's actually a plot point that makes sense.
Right.
But yeah, here it's just, I mean, if you took David out of the equation, it just it doesn't really change anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially as far as the motivation of this fight. Also, what? I mean, now that we're talking about it, I don't think Krug was like the best Klingon, which makes me think a little bit less of Kirk having almost been defeated by this guy. Because the thing that blows my mind every time I watch this movie is the last thing he does is beam 5 prisoners up onto a ship that has one guy on it.
Yes.
what was he thinking was going to happen?
That's a good point. I never considered that. Yeah.
When Kirk gets up, they're like, how many more are they? No, it's just him.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I was actually a little bit confused about that whole sequence because I thought they were doing a sort of prisoner swap where they were going to the Klingon ship, but somehow they get to the planet instead.
It makes, honestly, what would make more sense there is if they did that. So if they go, when they set the self-destruct thing, they're going to do a prisoner thing where they beam the crew onto the bird of prey.
Yep.
And then the other guys go into the Enterprise. And at that point, they're like, "Yo, well, now we have control of the ship." And then Kirk's like, "I got something I got to do." And then he goes down to the planet, you know, kick ass or something.
Right, sure.
But yeah, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to beam down to the planet and then you also beam down. That's the point where I was like, if I'm Krug, it's just me and the other guy left in the ship. If we just leave,
right.
It's just a wash. No one ever knows we're here.
They died with honor.
Everybody's dead.
Yep.
No problem, but he has to go down to the ship and, I mean, go down to the planet and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I think
trip and fall over and fall into a lava pit.
I think that kind of sums up my feelings about the movie. And I think we've talked about this one a good amount. This one, it's just, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I do want to point out one of my favorite things, which I don't know if it's directly where they got it in Spaceballs, but the scene where they figure out that Spock mind melded with McCoy by just playing Star Trek II on the TV.
it's lucky that the security cameras are always in that sort of thing. But my favorite of that is you didn't do Encounter at Farpoint because I was doing them by myself at that point. And my favorite moment of Encounter at Farpoint is when Riker, the Enterprise goes and picks up Riker and a couple other crew members, and so Picard and Riker have their first meet and greet in the ready room. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Picard's like, well, we had some crazy shit go down. We met this guy named Q and everything like that. He's like, here, let me give you a briefing to catch you up. And Riker sits down on the couch of the ready room and watches the footage from earlier in the episode on the TV screen.
Nice.
It's a hallmark of the genre, I suppose. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about before we wrap up this one?
Let me just try to find my notes here. And everything's frozen. Not really. Oh, Miguel Ferrer, first movie as
Navigator.
The smarmy guy on the comms there.
Yeah, that's
weapons or whatever he does. Always playing the asshole to great effect.
Yep.
And I like that Genesis basically turned the world into Springfield from The Simpsons, where they have different ecosystems within walking distance.
Yeah, that was something that annoyed me as I was watching it. Yeah,
like, yeah. I mean, I guess it leads into the fact that it's
falling apart.
Yeah, falling apart or whatever. But yeah, I think that was about it. I think we covered pretty much everything else.
Yeah, I think that was a good discussion. I think we covered pretty much everything in the movie. Maybe we're getting better at covering the movies, but I feel like we covered everything that I would want to talk about in that movie.
Same music too. Same composer.
Yeah, Horner, or whatever his name is.
Yeah, they clearly are. Well, obviously it's a direct sequel, but you know what I did want to mention, because I think this is the first time that I've really gotten to talk about this on the show. In any form, is how I've always found it fascinating that the future in movies, particularly pleasant futures, they usually don't do this as much in like dystopic futures, but the style and fashion and design of the future is always this weird skewed point from whatever like the modern thing is.
Right, yeah.
So it's like, if this movie's made in 1984, the future that they're showing you, 200 years in the future or whatever, is if everybody just dialed up the designs from 1984 every year for 200 years.
So
if they do it in Back to the Future 2, where it's like, yeah, it's like the future, but the future of 1989, where everybody dresses like exclusively like Vanilla Ice.
So if we make a Star Trek movie nowadays, it would just be extremely tight pants with sort of a fade haircut that goes yes. to a swoop on the top. Yeah,
they've gotten a lot better at it. As time has gone on, I think they've realized how silly that is. Because yeah. I mean, even in the I think the trick is basically to make it fairly relatable to now, but with like a couple accents. Like even in although they do have some pretty sweet jackets in Search for Spock. Kurt McCoy has a pretty rad leather jacket. Their jackets game is pretty good.
Yeah, the jackets are very good. What's funny to me, Chekhov basically wears a pink muumuu, I think, yeah. for like the entire movie.
Well, friggin' Kirk's outfit is like, it's got like a, it's like a red deep V blazer yeah. with like a tablecloth inside of it. It's like nicely folded into like this seashell pattern.
Yeah,
and it looks like it should be on the wall or something.
Yeah, it's like a wraparound sweater or something that he's wearing yeah. for his red bit. Yeah,
there's a lot more. I don't think we mentioned it in the last one, but there's a lot more people that have like helmets and shit.
Yes, very Star Warsy.
Yeah, security guards that wear like early 1900s football headgear for some reason. But yeah, it's just a really weird thing that it's always a skewed alternate timeline of if we just stayed in 1984 for 200 years.
Right. Yeah. It's tough to come up with the fashion. You know, like what are people going to be wearing? And it changes just so like we went from extremely baggy pants to extremely tight pants over the course of like 15 years. So who knows where things will take us in the future here.
But they have gotten better at it. I mean, even if you watch Star Trek Beyond, it's the stuff that's not on the ship is pretty believable. It's not super futury, at least not that I can remember.
Yep.
They've figured out, I think, the sweet spot of, oh yeah, they still wear these kinds of jackets. They've just got a little bit more of a zip to them, you know.
Well, you know, it's funny. We'll be talking about Mad Men eventually, but you know, is the even in the future, if guys were wearing the classic men's black jacket, suit jacket, is that ever going to go out of style? You know,
I don't think. I mean, that's basically been around for like 150 years.
Yeah, it's been since like the Civil War. So I mean, I'd imagine if you gave me a Star Trek episode of the future and someone wore basically a black jacket, I would say that's pretty much appropriate. I can understand.
The only difference is we're going to wear two ties instead of one tie.
Right. Just because the Federation is a unity, or they'll move on to bow ties or something like that.
Yeah, I was really hoping that I would have a wedding to go to in the year 2015 where they would understand if I showed up wearing two ties like in Back to the Future 2. But it never happened, unfortunately.
It was a bad year for weddings. It was a bad year for us all. I think we talked about this one pretty well.
Good year for the Cubs, though.
Good year for the Cubs. Yeah, go Cubbies.
Year off. That was 2016. But yeah, I think we did. We pretty much covered everything. I mean, there's not a – it's a weird movie. It's It's not bad. I wouldn't say it's necessarily good. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
I don't think it deserves the hate that it gets.
Yeah, I think that's true. My sort of final point would be, I think the motion picture is more interesting in a weird way. Not that it's a better movie, but it's like this one just feels kind of like a it feels very much like a sort of generic 80s action movie in a lot of ways. And
yes, it's a good way to put it.
It's not the sort of like failed interesting thing that the motion picture was, and it's not the actual good movie that The Wrath of Khan was. So it just kind of sits in that middle area. But yeah,
I feel like it falls in that pocket of, and I feel like I'm prone to this pocket a lot more since I watch a lot of stuff when I'm working now. So a lot of TV shows I watch, people who actually sit down and watch them think they're a lot worse than I do. But when I watch them, I think they're great. But there's a certain pocket where it's like a laundry foldable show or a laundry foldable movie where if you're not really paying 100% attention to it, it gets a lot better than it probably actually is.
Sure, yeah.
And I think this is one of those movies where if this was on in the background while you were kind of doing something else while you were watching it, I think it would come off a lot better because it hits beats that make sense.
Yes.
In the grand scheme of what a movie like this should do. But when you actually, you know, focus on it and you compare it to Wrath of Khan specifically, there's not a lot there.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a perfect summary of it. Well, guys, I'm going to give this one a 3 out of 5, I think. Mm-hmm. It's just that middle ground. I do regret, I need to go back and retroactively, I said 4 out of 5 for Khan, but for some reason I went back and thought about it. I was like, why the hell did I do that? And for some reason, I was comparing Khan against other movies when I'm not doing that for the episodes of the show. I'm not comparing a random episode of Star Trek against like a Mad Men episode. So I don't know why I did it for the movies. But Khan obviously is a 5 out of 5 for the Star Trek movies. I just wanted to go back and retroactively say that.
You just want to be cool, Wes. Basically, you want to be that guy who's like, Wrath of Khan is not really that good.
I just wanted to correct myself for that. I'm going to give this one a 3. What would you give it?
Yeah, I'd do the same. It's 3. It's perfectly fine down the middle.
Yeah.
Got good stuff. I mean, like you said before, I think it's probably more important for how it moves the larger design of stuff along than it is for anything that happens in it.
Yeah.
It's probably worth more for the Klingons and the way they look and the ship they fly than it is anything else.
Right. Yeah. That's probably a good point. But yeah, guys, thanks very much for listening. If you're on YouTube, like and comments, appreciate it. iTunes, you can write us there. All the iTunes podcatchers would be appreciated. Facebook.com/ThePenskeyPodcast. Go to Patreon.com/ThePenskeyFile. If you're interested in supporting the show and the shows and everything that we do, you can go there. A couple dollars a month, you get extra content. We talked about Miami Vice recently, and Mad Men will be going up at some point. And you can check it out there, Patreon.com/ThePenskeyFile. Clay, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me once again. I do have one question that I forgot to ask. Mm-hmm. Is this the only movie appearance of Sarek in the original series movies?
Yes. Is it? I think it is. Because I think he's in 6.
That's really weird to me. Because I feel like Sarek is like, when I think of Sarek, I'm like, oh, he's in fucking everything. He shows up all the time. But he really kind of doesn't.
Let me see here. I want to be sure. I guess he's in The Voyage Home.
Oh, I guess that makes sense because Spock's brother is in it. So
no, so The Voyage Home is the next one. He's on the planet with them in the very beginning. But that, well, it looks like
in that case, I'm surprised he's not in the fifth one because it would kind of make sense.
But yeah, you feel like Sarek has a bigger impact on things than he's actually present for.
Yeah, at least for some reason in my mind, when I think about Sarek, maybe I just ended up seeing the same episodes of the show all the time or something, but he just feels like he's always around. But I guess he's really not in it that much, which, you know, he's a good character. I like him.
Yeah, he is. And for people looking for the best Sarek episode, watch TNG's Sarek, because it's his best appearance in the series, I think. But that's about it. Cool. Well, Clay, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to the next one because I haven't watched in a long time.
Yeah, Voyage Home. So the whales are here, and then we'll be moving on to Final Frontier and Undiscovered Country.
I'm really looking forward to, you know, just taking that movie to the woodshed just so I can be the unpopular one. Like, you know, this movie isn't as good as everyone thinks it is. The whales are stupid.
The whales are one of those things that you can't believe it's whales, right? It's like it's that kind of an idea. But
it does have the Scotty computer joke, which is one of my favorite jokes ever. So
it's got the young punk on the bus. It's got it all. But yeah, we'll be back next week with The Voyage Home. So guys, thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.